Time is precious. Life is not just the passing of time. Life is not just the passing of time. Life is a collection of experiences, their frequency, and their intensity.
Now, here's a little story I got to tell.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the show. This is Giants Amongst Us, where we share in the unique human experience and where each and every time you plug in, you're going to hear real stories told by real people. People just like yourself. And right off the top, I hope this finds you in a good place. I hope this finds you in good spirits. And if not, well, then maybe after listening to this show, you'll feel a little better about the day and do whatever it is you need to do to find it within yourself to keep on trucking. And for those of you plugging in and tuning in for the very first time, every time we share a story and an experience, these are testaments and examples of what the human spirit is capable of. These stories, they come from all walks of life, people who have had their own unique struggles in life and how they found the resources and tools they needed to start making some changes, start working towards healing, start letting go of the pain and moving forward in a more promising direction. So if you're feeling stuck like Chuck, if you're feeling like you're in a rut right now, let these stories remind you of the fact that things can't get better. It's going to take some doing. It's going to take some work, but you're worth it. Know that. So kick your feet up or do whatever it is you do as you let this play on in the background. Let's enjoy this experience together. Today, Justin joins us, and he's got a story to tell. Justin comes from a small town in Montana, population of about 300 people, and as a child, throughout his childhood, he said things were lovely. He wouldn't change it for the world. He enjoyed it. It wasn't until his adolescence, moving into high school, that things started to get a little tricky in that small town of Montana caved in on him. You see, Justin was on the receiving end of being bullied on account of rumors, hearsay, and false accusations of doing something that he said he took no part in. But that didn't matter. His peers, people from school, a big chunk of the town in his world at that time were after him. He was being threatened verbally, physically. He was being harassed, bullied, abused. All of these things he had to deal with as a teenager to the point where he stayed inside. He didn't go to school. He didn't want to go outside. He stayed put. And this really damaged his spirit. It was to the point where he said a couple of times he tried to take his life, although in his words, they weren't honest attempts, but it was to that extent. So we know the things that we go through, whether it be abuse, whether it be trauma, whether it be pain, whatever it is that isn't dealt with, that has scarred us, has bruised us, has battered us. If we don't find a way to deal with it, it shows head, if not in the present, later on in years. And for Justin, later on in life, he found himself struggling with alcohol. He found himself tangled up in that web of a gambling addiction, severing relationships, destroying his self-worth and self-esteem to the point where he just became sick of who he had become. He became sick of running from his pain, his trauma, everything that was tormenting him for so long because of what he went through as a teenager. He decided to get real with himself and take those necessary steps to start getting better. So it isn't all about the pain. It isn't all about the hurt. Justin is also going to share those segments in his life to where he started to get better. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, this is Justin and his story. Welcome back to the show. This is Giants Amongst Us, where we share in the unique human experience. And today we've got another guest. I'm happy to share another connection with everybody listening on the other end. So I'd like to welcome Justin to the show. Thank you very much for taking time out of your day. You could have been doing anything. You could have been anywhere, but here we are having a little sit down. So welcome aboard, my friend.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I love being guests on these things. I've been on a few other ones as well. It's just something I love. So yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, right on. So just to kick this thing off, and for starters, you mind sharing with us a little bit about where you come from and how it was for you growing up?
Yeah, so I grew up in a really rural town in Montana, Drummond, Montana. The population was only 300. I would describe my childhood as, I wouldn't exchange my childhood with anybody. I just had a really good childhood. You know, we had the typical problems all kids have. You know, being a teenager was kind of a rough time for me. Really, really difficult time. But overall, I had a really good childhood. I moved into a bigger city, so to speak, Deer Lodge, Montana, when I was 18 years old. Population was only 5,000, so we're still talking a little tiny town. But it was much bigger than what I was used to. And yeah, I've just kind of been always just working and traveling and just trying to live my best life ever since.
Yeah. How was, now you said during your teenage years, it was a bit rough and you had some patchy spots along the way. What were some things that you were dealing with that was hard on you?
Yeah. You know, I did the, right around when I was a teenager, I met a girl and we started dating and things weren't going well. And in school, there was like this perception of me as like harming her and abusing her. And people had this perception of me, and then it turned into bullying, you know, and people were like trying to get me because I was supposedly abusing this woman, or I guess this girl at the time. And I was scared. I was scared to go to school. I didn't want to. I would refuse. I ended up dropping out. I started getting into drugs. And this was a teenager, you know, I attempted suicide twice. Both attempts, I definitely wouldn't say were honest attempts to die. I just was reaching out for help. And my mom took action and got me some help, and things got better for a while. And then it got worse again as I got older. So it was just kind of like this back and forth. It wasn't until I was about 27 when I started getting my life back together, when I started to kind of realize that I need to take some action and start changing the direction of my life. So from pretty much 15 until I was about 27, my life was miserable. It really was.
Man, so the bullying that you ended up being on the receiving end of because of these rumors or the gossip that was spread. This is in a town that was only 300 people, right? So, I mean, bad news travels fast.
Yeah, it was hard. It was really hard. Yeah, everybody knew everybody in our town, you know? And so if one person got word, it just kind of spread from that. And then even years after I was a teenager, I ran into people that were from Drummond that were parents of kids my age. And they even asked me about it. Like, what was going on back then? Cause it was such a big deal. And I was like, man, how you understand it is way different than how I experienced it, you know? And it was really hard for a long time because it never escaped me that this perception of me of being basically an abuser, it was awful. It was terrible.
Like hearing that, I'm imagining people coming to the house with pitchforks, you know, just if you're not, especially you said you dropped out of school. So you drop out of school to try to avoid it there. But like you mentioned, it's a small town. So going out in public, you're going to come across these people either way.
You're exactly right. And it was kind of like that, like pitchforks, you know, and torches. That's how it felt to me. And I didn't leave the house. I was too scared. I was genuinely terrified to leave the house. And if I needed to go if I wanted to go do something, I was thinking about carrying weapons with me just as for self-defense, you know, and it was that scary. It was that scary to me. Like, I was scared to death.
Did it ever get to the point where it got physical? You know, they were throwing rocks at you. They were chasing you down in a car and, you know, anything like that.
One time it happened, but it was so brief. What happened was somebody saw me out there and they were pushing me and like yelling at me and calling me names. And all I said is, do what you're going to do. I'm ready. Like, whatever you're going to do, go ahead and do it. Like, I expected this. It was time. And they just kept pushing me and kept pushing me and just calling me names. And eventually they just left, you know, they realized they weren't going to get a reaction out of me or whatever. whatever was going through their head. That was the only time, but I didn't leave the house enough for anybody to see me. And then when I said I moved to the city, it was kind of because of that. And then when I moved to what was called Deer Lodge, that was when I kind of felt a little bit normal because I got a job, and then my life kind of started getting back on track. Then I got a state job, and that was really a really good job. And then I started feeling like an adult and started feeling getting a little bit more self-confidence, but that stuff never really left me, you know, kind of rested on my conscience, you know, almost all my life. I mean, even to this day, you know, I'm pushing 40 years old, or I am 40 years old, and I still am affected by what happened to me as a teenager.
Yeah. A lot of that baggage that we carry around with us, and especially, let's just say, if it's not dealt with in a healthy manner, if we use things to cover it up, if we run from it, it just piles and piles, and it takes its toll on us throughout the years. And some things you're never going to shake, but you can figure out ways to maybe deal with it, or to deal with it in a healthy manner. So I could imagine, and like you mentioned, because of this, it's going to do a lot of things to you psychologically, emotionally, and there's ways that you probably were trying to cover the pain or to mask it with substance abuse. And
yeah, exactly. I think I'm glad you really brought that up, because there's definitely a correlation to how I live my life once I moved, based on what I experienced when I was a teenager. So, I was called a lot of names like pussy and faggot. They used a lot of those really emasculating words towards me. And I acted in those ways. Like I was in a sense a coward, you know, as far as anybody looking from the outside in would say, just go face it. And I never did. I would avoid it. I was too scared, you know, and it was very emasculating. Now, when I became an adult, I started drinking a lot. I drank a lot. I was constantly drunk. I gained a lot of weight. I put on, you know, probably about 120 pounds or more. Actually, it's probably like 160 pounds, pushing to 300 pounds. Once I got out of high school, I was really, got really, really fat. And again, that weighed on my self-conscious. But as I would drink, I would get really aggressive, but I never harmed anybody. But I would almost get to this point where I would try and intimidate and kind of reclaim some of my masculinity. So, and it was very toxic, and it was really, really unhealthy. And people would just beat the shit out of me. You know, I never fought back, and it was some weird psychological thing that I was going through where I would like basically kind of push these people to the limits, let them beat the shit out of me. And then I would just go home and, you know, just deal with it. It was terrible. It was an awful life. And I did that until, you know, I was 27. You know, when I started drinking, and then it kind of migrated into drugs. And when I was 26, 27, I really had a really, really bad experience with what I was told was ecstasy. And it was very much not that. And for probably 2 days straight, I was so depressed. It did something to me. It affected me differently than anything that I've ever experienced. And I was so, so depressed. And I remember telling somebody, I go, if I have to feel this way any longer than 3 more days, I'm going to kill myself. I cannot handle this. And I said, I understand people who are genuinely depressed. If they feel this way, them killing themselves was the right thing to do, because I cannot handle this anymore. And about 2 days, you know, things started wearing off, and I started kind of getting back to my senses. And then all of a sudden in my mind, everything just clicked. It was like, man, you cannot keep living this way. Look at your life. You're in your dad's basement. Here's this girl that you're sitting here and that is only here with you because you have a good connection. You know that there's nothing there. You are living a terrible life. You are a terrible person. Today you have to change. And that was the catalyst for me to start seeking help. And after that, you know, my life started coming back together once I swallowed some pride, acknowledged that I had a problem, and that I let somebody else help me. I learned that I couldn't do it myself.
Had you tried any time previous to that to try to kick your addictions or your habits?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that it was an honest effort, though. I recognized that it was a problem in my life. And I was like, oh, man, I should really cut back drinking. Or I shouldn't drink so much when I go out. Or I should stick to beer. You know, there's all these like weird things that you do.
Yeah.
You know, and I recognized that I had a problem. I wanted it to not be a problem, but I didn't want to stop. So, yeah, yes and no.
Yeah, because I also, you know, come from many years of abuse. And so there's ways that you can justify it. And, you know, I'm just gonna, like you said, just if you're drinking alcohol, which is anything and everything from wine to liquor to liquor to beer. But yeah, you can just justify, you know what, I'm just going to drink the, I'm not going to drink the hard stuff, just beer.
Yeah.
But like you said, is that really an honor? Do you really want to let it go? Are you sick of it? Are you, so how did that look like for you once you finally got to the point where you were just sick and tired of feeling the way you were feeling and living the way that you were living?
Yeah. Yeah. So what happened was I literally just kind of, it felt like I just woke up. Like I just, as a human, just appeared in this situation and I was fully aware of everything that was going on in this new person's life. Like I didn't even feel like myself. And it was just like a light switch.
Wow.
And it dawned on me that I needed to go get help. And that's what I did. I pretty much left my situation, just up and left, and stayed with some friends in the town over. And I went to a outpatient drug treatment facility and just said, I need help. And they're like, yeah, come on in. And, you know, they did their assessment and said, you need inpatient drug therapy. You need to go to inpatient therapy, which is rehab. And I was like, okay, whatever. And I basically submitted to that. Whatever they said, I was like, you guys are the experts. I'm going to listen and do what you tell me. I don't care what it is.
Walk me through.
If they would have handed me a butter knife and said, cut off your leg, I would have just sawed through my leg just so I could stop. Yeah, it was that bad for me. When I went to rehab, I felt like I was probably one of the few people that was taking it seriously. And so that was hard, but it gave me enough motivation to maintain my sobriety. And from rehab, I went into a drug home, I guess you could saw it, like a halfway house, I guess you could call it that. It was not a good situation and it was unhealthy and it was a very toxic place, but I still maintained my sobriety during that time because I was so determined to no longer live the life that I was. I went to AA meetings, NA and AA meetings, which were invaluable. I can't even explain how much they helped me during that time. And I did that for like 3 years. Within the first year of kind of going in that halfway house, you know, I had a good job. I got my own apartment after a year. I ended up getting married, which was too quick. I should have never gone that fast. But my life was slowly coming back together. After a year and a half, you know, I got custody of my kids and everything just started working out. And there were some promises that that AA gave, and they reached far beyond anything that I could have expected. And, you know, this was back when I was 27. So that was 13 years ago. I would have never dreamed that I'd be the person that I am today.
Wow. That's a hell of a ride. And also that, I mean, you were putting just as much effort into it, it seemed like. You know, you were sold into the idea of getting well, whatever it takes. So like you said, if they were going to give you a butter knife and said, go ahead, have at it, chop your leg off, then I'm going to saw that leg off if it's going to get me well. But you were completely sold and ready, just sick of being sickly and disgusted and living the way that you were living. And you mentioned the drug rehab and that was a big, you know, I've never been to rehab. The only thing I had to do once upon a time was, and that was on account of my probation, was alcohol classes. But you did say that the drug rehab for you, that, you know, that was a big help. Is there something I'm not too familiar how that process works. Was there something in particular that stands out that really was a great resource or a tool to help you towards this sobriety?
Yeah, there was. They talked a lot about like criminal thinking and kind of like warning signs of that you're going to relapse. Those were the two biggest things. You know, when you start kind of being sneaky and doing these little things like, oh, yeah, I can make a quick buck by doing this, and it might not be exactly the most honest way of doing it. That's when you got to start taking a step back and being like, hey, I'm working myself right into a relapse, you know, and that kind of that criminal thinking mentality kind of puts you right back into those old unhealthy behaviors. Once I was able to really kind of be conscious of my actions and what I was doing subconsciously was when I was able to kind of detach myself from those actions, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And how was it for you in the beginning dealing with your sobriety? And, you know, because when you're under the influence, that's one of the things some of us love being under the influence, is because you escape from your problems, your anger, your issues, your emotions, your past, your failures, everything. So how about once the sobriety was set in stone and you were riding that wave, were you dealing with the flood of emotions that, you know, at one time you were suppressing or running away from or covering up with different devices or different vices, should I say? How was that like dealing with them with a sober mind?
Yeah, you know, it seems like you have a pretty good grasp of exactly how all this goes, because you cross addict, right? So
yeah,
you'd be sitting there like, oh yeah, I'm not drinking alcohol. And then you can do like what they call the California sobriety, where you just smoke weed.
Yeah.
A lot of people do that, you know? So, and that doesn't typically work out for people. Each person's journey is different, so I can't judge, but it certainly wouldn't have worked for me. And what happened was, and this is going to sound really weird, and I think anybody that might have gone through this might understand, you know, I wasn't drinking, I wasn't doing drugs, I was doing really well, but then that slowly turned into gambling. And the gambling was the hardest thing for me to, I would argue that I still haven't gotten over it. It's definitely much more mild than it was back then, but I would go to the casino and I would gamble rent away. And then I would leave there like, how the fuck did this happen? And I was almost in autopilot, where I wasn't in control of my body.
Yeah.
I would go over to the ATM and I'd be screaming in my mind, don't do it. What are you doing? Go home. Take your losses. Take your losses. Stop. And I'd be screaming at myself in my mind.
Yeah.
And I'd be like shaking, putting my ATM card into the ATM. And then I'd take out $200 and then put it in the machine. It was so bizarre. And then what I noticed, I started really kind of taking a step back, and I'd be like, if my house was dirty and I knew I had to go home after work and clean, I would avoid that by going to the casino. And it was something so simple as that, where I felt uncomfortable going home. So instead, I would just zone out on these machines. Like, I would just be gone.
Mm.
Like, the whole world would disappear and it would be me and this machine. Very bizarre.
Yeah, man, that's funny that you say that, because along with the alcohol and the drugs, I was hooked. When I was young, I'd like to shoot craps, but then as I got older and then I was able to get into the casinos, poker, No Limit Texas Hold'em, man.
Oh, no.
It was unbelievable. And it's crazy that they had, I'm sure they probably have it in every casino, but and maybe you noticed it, but you can go there and cash your check. And they're going to give you, you know, money to play with and gamble off.
I'm lucky.
Check advances.
We're lucky that we don't have that here in Montana. Our casinos are run very differently than your typical. So there's some things that are preventative for that. So I couldn't imagine if I could just bring in my work check and just cash it. There's like, here's an extra $100 you can play on the table.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it would have been the death of me.
Wow. So how long? And when you were in the casinos, that's hard to do, because I don't think I was ever able not to drink when I was in there. So you were in there sober, but just gambling your savings away, your rent away.
Yeah, you know, it was weird. I was so determined. I just stopped liking alcohol, which was weird. It just, my mind switched. When my mind switched at 27, it was seriously like a light switch. I just got smashed in the face with this enlightenment of alcohol being bad. That is not to say that I've had drinks afterwards. I have. There were certain situations, social situations, where I did break and had one or two drinks. But then I was like, I don't like this. This is not me. This is not who I am. And I wouldn't do it again for 5 or 6 years. And as a matter of fact, you're from Germany. When I went there about 4 or 5 years ago, that was the first drink I had was in Germany
Wow.
when I went back there in, 10 or 11 years or something like that.
And how'd that taste like for you after so long? Something that you didn't miss?
It was a beer. It was weird because, the people's addictions manifest themselves in many different ways. And my addiction just never really centered around alcohol so much. Even though I would
Okay.
recognize myself as an alcoholic, I could have beer in my fridge for months without drinking it. It was more about when I was out and I started drinking was when it became a problem. I just couldn't stop. So it was a really strange relationship I had with alcohol. But when I was in Germany and I had that drink, I think it was Stella. Stella, is that what was the big?
Stella Artois.
Yeah, is that the big one there? There was like a is like the Budweiser of Germany.
I don't know. Is that a if it's a German beer or a French beer? I could be wrong. No, you might be right. But I know of Stella, but there's so many beers over here, and it's funny because every region takes pride in their own beer. Every state, every
Oh, I see.
town, every city. Yeah. So maybe Hamburg, they had their own special like tap beer that was real big. But I do know Stella. It's in a green bottle.
Yeah, okay. So I think it was Stella. I'm not sure. But anyway, it doesn't matter what it was. But it was like I saw advertised everywhere. And I'm like, I'm just going to have one. And it did. It brought me a lot of joy. And I was sitting there. I remember I was just drinking this beer. And I was like, this is really cool. I'm in Germany. This is my first international trip, And I'm like, this is cool. I'm in Germany drinking German beer. This is just so neat. And then I just left it. I just left it. And that was it
Okay.
for many, many years. So it's a really weird relationship.
When we're talking about once you hit your sobriety and you were living a sober life, but then you picked up the gambling and you were on a wreck with that, how were you able to manage that? And what was the thing that switched on or switched off for that matter to where you, I don't know if it's safe to say you stopped gambling completely or you still like to dibble and dabble with it here and there?
Yeah, that's the sad reality. And if I got to get honest with myself, I've never had control over my gambling. I might go long periods where I don't gamble, but once I start, I don't stop until it starts really start ruining things, and then I back off. And how I managed it back then, now I was raising 2 daughters as well, and I was gambling on top of it, and I'm trying to work a job, gamble and take care of these kids and just live a life. And I couldn't live. And how I managed to do all that is take on more work. I started becoming a workaholic and I had 3 jobs at one time. It really, really affected my relationship with my kids, more so than probably what I want to admit. And once the pandemic hit, and I got laid off from all my jobs and we were getting the stimulus and all this stuff is when things started to really turn for me as far as my gambling addiction. And even though I was making more money not working than I was when I was working 3 jobs, not being able to do anything and just reflect on my life was pivotal, was probably the most impactful thing that happened to me beyond my rehab stint, my sobriety. And
Yeah.
I just looked at my life and I'm like, my kids are suffering because of me. I don't get to see them. I'm not present like I should, And I never doubted me as a father, my ability to be a good father, but I was certainly not doing them any good living the life that I was. And I took that as an opportunity to start trying to change my life. And I did. I really started researching ways of making money and making my money work for me. And I learned about the stock market. I did really well. I still do all right. Not as good as the pandemic era, but still doing all right. And I made a little nest egg for myself. And it allowed me to take time off of work and focus on my relationship with my kids. And it was one of the best things that ever happened for our family. It was great.
You know, something about, and I think that's probably even relatable to drug addiction, but something about gambling also, and I don't know if you dealt with this, I'm pretty sure you probably did in your own way, but when you're gambling, you're not just going through it right then and there because, you know, you may be after your losses or the adrenaline pump, whatever it is. But then even after the fact, it is wearing you out emotionally, psychologically, because you're thinking about the time you spent in there, how much time you wasted, how much money you lost. And then it's a big shot on your self-worth, on just anything, your dignity, your human dignity. I don't know if these were some things that you were dealing with during the time you were gambling, from you being in a casino and even when you're outside of the casino, because your mind is still thinking about that last visit or the visit before that.
Oh man, you nailed it on the head. That is exactly what I would go through, because I'd go in there and it was mostly afterwards when I was had that like clarity of what just happened. Like I'll be in the casino and like getting angry because I'm losing all this money, but the reality doesn't really set in until afterwards. And I'll sit there and be like, $500. I could have done so much stuff with $500 and it took me 1 hour to lose all of that. And there was times when I would go in my car and I would start driving home and I just start yelling at myself.
Oh my God.
Fucking idiot. I was like, you're fucking stupid. And it was just so weird. I just never had loss of control like that. Even when I was drinking, I recognized that I didn't really have control over alcohol, you know, to a certain extent, you know, but I could have it in my fridge for months without drinking it. So I did have some level of control. I really never understood loss of control until it applied to gambling. Completely lose control over it, 100%.
Man, when you said that, yelling in the car, why did I see flashbacks of myself doing the exact same thing? And then now that you mentioned, out of everything, all the pills that I popped, the dope that I smoked, the drink that I drank, everything, I don't recall as many moments of me outbursting the way I did after losing and spending the time that I did in the casino. Even sometimes where I was driving, I remember in the parking lot, I'm driving through the parking lot, and then there was some people, I'm driving after I blew I don't know how much money, and I hear these people laughing outside. They're going into the casino, and I roll the windows down, and I was like, what the fuck are you so happy about? Yeah. And I'm surprised they didn't just come at the car.
That's man. Funny. You know, that's the thing. There's not a better high that I've ever had when it came to winning, but there's never been more sorrow that I felt than from losing. And that up and down, and it's so fast. It could be 1 minute you're way up here, and then next you're going, what the fuck? And you're like, no, stop, as you're pushing that button. You know, as you're just watching the money go down. So
did you ever try to do the where you leave your wallet, your car's at the house, and just put maybe $100 of cash in your pocket and say, this is, go to the casino and think that that's all you're going to spend for the day?
You know, I learned from Vegas, they had these like little brochures where it's like, do you have a gambling addiction? Here, this is, you know, if you mark, you know, 4 out of these 10, you might have a gambling addiction. And I was like 9 out of 10. And there were some things that it said you can do. Wow. Is like, leave your stuff in your car, because by the time you walk to your car, you'll come to your senses and you'll go home. And I did that. I was in Colorado. It was Black Hawk, Colorado. They have this really big casino area up on a mountain. And it's really neat. It's really cool. And that's what I did. As I left all my money in there, I took $300 into the casino, and I lost it almost immediately, and I was pissed. And I just walked right out to my car, grabbed my wallet, and walked right back in.
Oh.
And it didn't work at all. So, but beyond that, there was other things. Like, I had a prepaid debit card that I would load money on occasionally, and I would take it out of the ATM until that went to zero. Then I had to stop, but that didn't work because I just rationalized in my head, oh, I can just take from my other bank account. So I'd drive home and maybe wait a couple hours and then just grab my regular debit card and head down to the casino again. So it didn't matter. There was nothing stopping me.
Yeah, yeah, that's a different kind of monster to deal with in itself. Is it safe to say that you have a lot better a relationship with gambling?
Yeah, because one, in Thailand, they don't have any casinos there. And that helped me because I realized how much more productive I am when I'm not out there gambling. I wrote a book, I published a book.
Okay.
And it's just a small short story, it's horror. I published that, and then I started creating music, and I have a few albums that I created. I can't sing, so they're just like lo-fi kind of relaxing music. But I was wildly productive when casinos weren't available to me. I got so much done. I even started a podcast with a buddy there in Thailand.
Oh, man, okay.
Just because I was refocusing my time and energy into other things. And I couldn't just say, I'm bored, I want to go to the casino. Instead, I was like, I'm bored, let's do something creative. And that worked for me. Now being back in Montana, I don't really have the desire that I did. Now, when I came back from Thailand, I did stop in Vegas, and I was lucky enough to come out ahead after a day. And then I came to Montana. The addiction part of me started kind of slowly revealing itself. Like, I didn't sleep for almost 36 hours. I think I had 4 hours of sleep in 36 hours because I was so like excited at being in Las Vegas that I didn't need sleep. I felt good. I would go and take a quick nap, and then I'd wake up and I felt energized.
Mm-hmm.
And what started happening is I was like, I knew my body was like screaming, you need sleep, but I felt energized. I made myself go lay down. I was like, you are going to stay in this freaking room until you fall asleep, like a real sleep. And I just laid there and I fell asleep, and I woke up about four hours later, and I was like, all right, got my sleep. And then just went right back down to the casino.
Once you, like you said, you didn't have these vices that were taking up your time, there was a lot of creative energy inside of you that was flowing in different directions with the music, with the podcast, with the, you said writing the book even. Now, I didn't know any of this beforehand. So, the music and the podcast and the book, are all these things available if you want to send anybody in that direction to check it out? And
oh, yeah, yeah. I'm glad. I didn't even think about that, like kind of promoting it. But yeah, I'll do a quick plug. If you want to check out the podcast, me and a buddy there in Thailand, we did this podcast. It's all about fun. We kind of talk about our experiences in Thailand. And we both kind of live different lifestyles. And we kind of introduce each other to a different way that people live. And it hopefully will kind of enlighten some people. It's all good heart, good natured, and fun. It goes by the Pillow Pals podcast. You can look it up on Spotify, Amazon, Samsung, all these different places that allow podcasts. As far as the book goes, it's called There Are Ghosts in These Pages, 5 Tales That Follow You Home. You can find it on Amazon. That was the easiest way to get it published. Basically, the author's name is Julius Edwards. He was this really enigmatic person, very quiet, kind of a recluse. He had died, and the Edwards family kind of inherited all his house and everything. Well, once they went into his house, they realized that he had written millions of books and philosophies and music, and he drew pictures. He was into art. But there was a connection to like paranormal and the supernatural. And when the family started reading these books, there was hauntings that came with those books. And so they try, what they're trying to do is publish Julius Edwards's books in order to kind of dilute these hauntings and kind of pass it on to the reader. So that was their hope, that they can wash their hands of these hauntings and pass it on to the reader.
Okay, hence the title.
Yep. There are ghosts in these pages, five stories that follow you home. And there's only really actually four stories. The fifth one is more of an explanation, I guess. And then as far as the music, if anybody's into like lo-fi music and just relaxing Zen, you can check out Tranquility North. I'm on all the different streaming platforms, just about anyone that you can think of.
Yeah, I'm always down to throw on some lo-fi when we're around the house and just relaxing. And you can shoot me a link to all of it, so then I can include it in the show notes and people can click on it and it'll send them right there.
Oh, great. Yeah. Thanks, man. I appreciate that. Yeah. Thank you for the shout out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No problem. You know, just to play. Now, we were talking about the gambling, and I said that I was really stuck on, even to this day, you know, I love playing poker because I feel like there's a science behind it, and it's not all gambling. Like, you do need some luck, but it's a lot of skill reading people and things like that. And so the reason I brought this back up, because playing devil's advocate and seeing that, or hearing that you're also involved in the stock market, and there's some people on the outside that say, well, you know what? Isn't that kind of like gambling?
Yes. Bottom line, it is. I get the same rush as I do in the stock market as I did when I was gambling. As far as how it affects me, it's no different, honestly. I mean, if I be true to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had it all. I won. I mean, if you want to call it that, I won a ton of money one time, and I was pretty much set for life. And then I started gambling again, basically gambling on the market. And I took these huge risks with this enormous reward, thinking, oh, I'm going to be a billionaire. And I was deluded. I was so delusional in lying to myself that this was actually going to happen. And I believed it. And I lost almost all of it. I lost almost all of it. And it really had an impact on my life. Negative at the time. In retrospect, now I'm kind of glad I've washed my hands of it, because I was kind of turning into somebody I didn't like. I was hoarding money. I was really stingy, even though I had more money than I ever could have imagined I would have. I started becoming more like, do I really want to spend money on that? And I was more protective of my money. It was really weird. And then, you know, and then when I lost it all, it kind of snapped me back to reality. And I became a person that I like more than I ever have. And so I'm kind of grateful for that experience, but at the same time, I wouldn't have to work right now if I still had that money. But I remember sitting in front of the stock market. I would wake up at 4:30 in the morning. This is when I lived in Spokane, Washington for a year.
Did you do a lot of background studying before you got into it, or you kind of learned as you went?
The pandemic, that's when I learned it.
Uh-huh.
Yes. And I took 7 months. I would take like $500 and I play around with it so I could understand how options work and how these other things would work, other positions would work. And I took 7 months and like only like $500 and just kind of played around with it. And I started to kind of understand it. And I started making these bigger and bigger bets, and I started winning a lot. And then I remember I'd wake up at 4:30 in the morning without an alarm. I just wake up naturally and just start, get on my computer and start looking at the pre-market. What's moving?
It's go time.
And then, you know, I take my daughter to school. Then I'd get on the computer until about 3 o'clock, go pick her up, or 2:30, go pick her up from school, and then stay on there until about 4. That was my day every single day, Monday through Friday. And I would remember, like, when I'd have really good days, I would just be sitting in front of my computer shaking, like just with this adrenaline rush of like, wow, what an awesome day today was. And all I would think about is the stock market. I would get on like earnings calls and I would just sit there and play them. They'd be 2 hours long and I would just sit there and listen to these earning calls. It was an obsession, no different than gambling.
Yeah. And it's crazy because you know, there was a time where you had to go into a stock exchange and make all the moves, but because everything's digital, I mean, it's at the hip because you have it on your phone and wherever you're at, even if you're not in front of your computer, you can be out maybe taking your kids to have, you know, a little bit of fun at the park, but you're not even enjoy that because you're on the phone checking out the stocks.
It's not that you're not enjoying it and you're not present for your kids and they see that in you.
Yeah,
they know exactly. That you're not there. You're gone. And that's happened. That happened.
You're checked out.
Mm-hmm. That happened. I was lucky for me that when by the time my daughter got off school, the stock market had closed. So I could just kind of focus my time on her. But if I had little kids that weren't in school, I'd have been completely detached until that market closed.
Were you doing day trading too? Was that what, like?
That's where I made all the money. It was just day trading. I would just sit there and buy and sell stock. That's all I would do all day.
Well, you have to be that. That's in real time. You have to be moving with, you know, just as the second is ticking.
Yep. You have to babysit it the entire time. It's not like, oh, I'm going to invest in the SPY and just let it sit for 5 years. It wasn't like that. There was times where I was probably doing 40 or 50 trades a day, easy.
Man, and that whole time you're on edge. I'm sure you're taking your emotional roller coaster is hitting highs, hitting lows, just at the, you know, the drop of a dime.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Yeah, it was like that.
Like your heart. You don't need a Red Bull or anything. Your heart's jumping out of it's damn near jumping up out of your chest.
There were days like that. Yeah, there were definitely days like that. But there was also Also, you know, like just like with gambling, you try and set limits like, oh, if I make $500 today, I'm going to quit. And you might do that one or two times. And then you're like, wow, my first trade, I made $500. Well, what am I going to do with the rest of my day? Trade. You know, so you go right back into it, you know. So you're right. Those highs and lows were no different for me than if I was at the casino hitting a jackpot and then losing it all. That I'd hit that same high. And then I'd be down in that same sorrow.
At one time you were drinking and then you were abusing substances in that sense. And then you came to an awakening. It was almost like that old biblical story when Paul, he was ruthless and vicious. And they said he was out there causing mayhem and he was going to go pillage the next town or whatever. And just out of nowhere, he was knocked off the horse. Something in the cloud spoke to him and he automatically just like that changed his life around and he turned his life over to spreading the good news. And it seemed like you just had an awakening. I don't want to drink alcohol. I don't like the taste of it. It doesn't do anything for me anymore. You went to the meetings and you got yourself clear. And then you started dealing with the gambling and then you were able to sort your way out of that. There's a lot of twists and turns in your journey.
Yeah. And, you know, and just kind of reflecting back on your story of Paul, it was very much felt that same way because I don't prescribe to much of a divine entity. I never have, but it certainly felt like there was a higher power at play that was kind of giving me some kind of knowledge about myself. Like I was completely detached from any emotion that I had in my life. And I just saw my life for what it actually was. And I realized I had to change. And it was like a light switch. I'm not even kidding. You know those stories of people that like get hit in the head and they start speaking in an accent?
Yeah.
That's kind of how it felt. It felt like I was had so much trauma from coming off of what was supposed to be ecstasy that my brain was like, dude, we need to change. Something needs to change.
Divine intervention in some way, shape, or form. Yeah, so it was that complete low that you hit. And once you came off of that, you came to the realization, the revelation and epiphany, the light switch went on, something of the sort to where that was when you started taking steps towards sobriety.
Yep.
At a running pace.
Yeah, it was. And it really was like that. I think, you know, I did outpatient for like a couple weeks. I was inpatient. And then I ended up, you know, I was inpatient for about a month. I ended up in a completely different place. And then I stayed in that place for another 10 years and thrived.
Wow. Are you talking about with the AA and the NA, you stayed in that for 10 years?
Yeah. So I ended up in a completely different town. If anybody wants to look, I moved to a beautiful part of our state. I live right outside of Glacier Park. It's a beautiful area. I don't think there's anywhere in the world that's quite comparable to what I've experienced in Glacier Park. But I moved up there. I stayed up there for 10 years, and I was probably in AA for 7 of those years until I moved away from Kalispell.
Did you feel like when you ended up staying away for it for a long period of time, a long stretch, did you feel like that you needed it and you weren't going to be able to hold on to your sobriety without it? Or did you feel like there was a time and a place that you would eventually be able to, I wouldn't say stand on your own, because you're using a lot of the tools and resources that you gained from that, but that you would be able to do things apart from, you know, attending the meetings the way that you were attending them?
No, I at that time, I was pretty much committed to going to meetings for the rest of my life. I saw the value in it. I saw the camaraderie. I saw it working for me, and it worked very well. I mean, I couldn't have done it without those meetings. As time went on, I guess, and I don't want anybody to hear this and think that AA or NA is inherently bad in any way. I think it is great for everybody if you let the program work how it's supposed to work and you do what is suggested in the meetings. But I kind of started feeling like they weren't working for me anymore. And I kind of started seeing the problems with it that I didn't like. People do get sentenced to go to like NA and AA. So sometimes there's people in there that may not have the best intentions
for the wrong reasons.
Yes, exactly. And I was seeing like kind of predatory behavior that I didn't like. And I've never been a godly person, and they've always, the biggest thing is like kind of turning it over to a higher power. And I had a hard time with that personally, and being submissive, even though in the early years, I was really submissive to the program. But I started kind of realizing that some of these people might not know exactly what they're talking about.
Mm.
And it wasn't until I went back to school for social work, where I started to kind of learn about human beings. You know, I had to take some sociology classes, psychology classes. And I started realizing that these people are acting as therapists to vulnerable people, and it can easily go awry if you do not pick the right person to kind of have as a sponsor or the right people in the program. It can go awry really easily. I stopped going because of that, but I have to give credit where credit is due. I would not be who I am today without those meetings. I found the right people, and I took the good things out of it that it offered. I took full advantage of the program and made it work for me. And one of the sayings is like, keep coming back. It works if you work it. And that is exactly true. But you have to really make sure you're careful. You can get yourself involved with the wrong people.
Yeah. I've heard of mixed emotions when it comes to AA and NA. And I think you used it to your benefit, and you use it the way that it should be, because, you know, this is kind of just me on the outside looking in. I think when it comes to most things, if you're talking about maybe an instructor, a teacher, if you're going to classes to learn something, the whole point is for you to get there at first. Maybe you're a baby. You don't understand anything. You don't know what it's about, how it's going to work, but you follow along, you apply the tools and everything that they're instructing you to apply into your life. And then you eventually get to the point where now you can go ahead and you can step out and do these things on your own without, I don't want to say the training wheels anymore, but you can really leave the nest, and you don't need the teacher that the way that you once did. So I think even in something like that, some people, they might stick around for life because they think that they need that. But there's some in 6 months, in 8 months for you, however long it was, you felt like, okay, I'm not getting anything from it anymore. But you did take everything that was useful. You applied it to your life, and it worked to your favor.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think that, everybody's journey is different. And I'm not going to judge anybody for whatever path they take. So if somebody says, oh, I can't drink anymore, I don't want to drink, I'll never drink again. And then, you know, after a month or so, they start going out and drinking again. I don't know. Maybe that is okay. Maybe that'll turn out to be just mm-hmm. fine for them. I don't get to judge that, you know? So yeah, I think you're right. I think you really nailed it on the head when you said maybe that 3 years or however long, or I went there seven or 8 years actually, was just what I needed in order to kind of have enough tools
to build that foundation.
Exactly. Have enough to get me to where, hey, I'm good now. Thank you so much for this hand up. Thank you. You know?
Yeah. And I think also that gives that also does something for you and puts a little extra gas in your tank, because now that you see, like, you know, I'm out here and I'm doing this apart from attending the meetings the way that I was attending, I'm standing on my own, so to speak. So, I mean, that's got to do a little something for your self-worth and your self-esteem and your confidence level.
Yeah. And it also allowed me to kind of branch out, and because my life was consumed by AA meetings. Like, I would go almost every
day. Oh, I could imagine. Are we talking Monday through Sunday?
They had them. Yeah, it was every day. I didn't go like that frequently, but they were available to me that frequently. And, you know, there would be times where I would go 7 days a week, and there might have been times where I went once a week. You know, there's no really, you just show up when you feel like you need it. And I did. There were times where I was, all it was AA, AA. That's all I was on my mind. That's all I cared about. And it was because out of sheer desperation to stay sober. And they were always there for me. And everybody that was there for me, because I could go in there and I could say, hey, I'm Justin, I'm an alcoholic, I have a really shitty fucking day and I need some people to help me get through this. And there would be an overwhelming response. Hey, come see me. Let's go get some coffee. Let's go have lunch. I'll buy you dinner, whatever. It would be an overwhelming support there, like overwhelming support. And I am very grateful for that. I don't want to get anybody the wrong impression about AA or NA. It is a very, very effective program. Bottom line, it just got to the point for me personally that I felt like I grew out of it.
Right on. You're talking about your personal journey, and that's really what the show is about. Every time I connect and talk with somebody, it's about their personal journey. And it's not to say one size fits all. What worked for you is going to work for the next man or the next woman, but some things can click and resonate with them. And maybe you pick a little bit from this that sounds right or feels right. And then a little bit from them and a little bit from them. And you apply it and you hybrid it and make your own machine and working mechanism within yourself. And you work out your own issues and you sort out your own journey along the way. So it's not any kind of cookie cutter.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, but you know, the sad thing is that we're kind of always told at a young age, like, go to college, do this, do that. You have to fit in this little box. And it wasn't until I got older that I realized, hey, you know what? I don't fit in this box. I'm going to do what I want and what makes me happy and what makes me feel good. And I'm not going to, as far as I can, without harming anybody else, you know? And it wasn't until I just realized I have my own path. You might not like what I do, but I like what I'm doing. And then that's when I started getting happy. That's when I found true happiness in my life, is when I was authentic to myself.
That's awesome that you said that, because you took us on a course of some of your troubles, your challenges, your mistakes, your pains, and the ways that you dealt with it and the unhealthy ways that you dealt with it. But now you're in a better place, it sounds. And you were telling me about some things that you have going on nowadays. You mind just sharing a little bit about that? You don't have to get into too many specifics, but even the plans of you spending some of your time overseas.
So I feel very fortunate, and I'm very grateful for my position that I'm in. You know, right now I'm only going to be working like six months out of the year. Go back and live in Thailand, where I just love the country. It's a beautiful country, wonderful people there. And that's kind of where I'd like, if I could, I'd just permanently stay. It's just such a great environment, a great welcoming environment for anybody, all walks of life. Doesn't matter what you're into, who you're into, how you want to live your life. Everyone just kind of keeps to themselves and allows each person to live how they want to live. And it's just such a comforting thing. And, you know, my kids have grown. My daughter graduates actually today is her graduation. So I'll be going to that in a couple hours. And they're all grown. So I have this freedom that I never had. And I've never been happier. And I couldn't have done it if I hadn't got sober and I didn't swallow the pride that I had back then and sought help. I couldn't do it on my own. There's no way. I'd probably be dead if I would have stayed on this path. But yeah, I've traveled all over the world. I've been, you know, Southeast Asia, you know, I've been to Germany. We talked about Hamburg and where you're at, and, you know, Costa Rica, Ireland, Iceland, just all over.
Globetrotting.
And it's all because I invested on myself and in myself and my own personal well-being. I had to become number one before I could be of help to anybody. And once I put myself first and my health, my relationships with everybody else flourished. And I felt more close to the people that I love more than I ever did.
Man, that's beautiful. Globetrotting. And now that it's like you got your second wind and you're not even, you know, they say the average American, or you can just apply this to whatever country you live in, is going to have to get used to working to the rightful age of 65 or 75 to retire and finally start enjoying. You know, you're putting X amount of years into a company, but then when you're able to finally say, I'm done now, I'm just living off of retirement, how old are you? And are you still able bodied to move around and enjoy yourself? But it's a beautiful thing to be where you're at right now and to have the freedom to be able to, you know, work X amount of months and then go ahead and enjoy your life the way you'd like to enjoy your life, off the clock.
Exactly. I don't have anybody telling me I have to be up at 9 and I have to work until 5 and you get a 30-minute lunch break. You know, I don't have to deal with that day in and day out for years and years and years. And then finally I get to dictate my life. And I'd like to add that it's not just because I took my well-being and my mental health came first. I also stopped caring about what other people thought of me to some degree. You know, if you take it to extremes, that can be a problem. But I started living my life as authentically as I could based on who I am. And once I started doing that, I started becoming more and more happy. And, you know, people value things differently. Like if you looked at my brother, for instance, I think he values like, hey, look at my car and look at all these toys I have in this nice house that I've got and look at how I live. And for me, and that's how he wants to live. And he finds happiness in that. But for me, I was like, look at all these experiences that I've gained. Look at all these people that I've met. Look at all this cool stuff I get to do. And that's where I found value. Yes. And once I was able to kind of break from that cage, so to speak, of like, you have to go to college and you have to get the good job and work until you can retire and then you retire, then you can do those things. Once I broke that mold, because that wasn't for me, it is for other people, that's when I found happiness.
Yes, you're investing in experiences and memories, and that is something I think is a lot more valuable than any kind of toy, any kind of shining object. I feel the same way. I'm with you on that. I feel the same way about those things, the experiences and the memories that come with it, and just looking to enjoy more of those while you're able to. And I was happy to hear a lot of what you had going on, how you were able to wiggle out of that, and how that you're in a much better place now, especially with your daughter graduating and you have that to get to. That's going to be nice to see.
Yeah, very proud of her. She graduated, I think, with a 4.0. I couldn't be more proud. Yeah, I cannot be more proud of her. And she's going to go to college. And I think that the only reason that she turned out the way she was is because I've been able to afford more time with her. And I valued time with my family over money. And because of that, I think she's where she's at now.
That counts for a lot. That quality time is especially at those critical stages of their life and that age. Man, so I'm going to include the links to everything that you have going on. And yeah, man, I really appreciated your story and what you had to share with us. If you like to, before we wrap this thing up, because I know you also have some things going on, like your daughter's graduation, but if you'd like to wrap it up with some final words or anything you'd like to leave off with, feel free, my friend.
Yeah. For anybody that's listening, whatever you're going through, I promise you things can be better, and just don't give up, but always to try and take baby steps in order to help and get better. And I promise you things will get better as long as you keep trying and your heart's in the right place. I have a saying, do the right things and the right things will come. And I can almost guarantee that eventually, as long as you keep doing the right things, your life will get back together. Don't give up. I've been there. I've wanted to give up. I tried giving up once, twice in my life. I'm really glad that never happened. And I'm finally at a place in my life that I can look at who I am and say I'm happy with where I'm at and who I've become. So stick in there. Stick it out. Power through it.
1,000%. My pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thank you, my friend. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you again, Justin, for being a part of this human experience and for opening up your heart and being transparent with us. Sharing those struggles, sharing those challenges that you face with addiction, with the drinking, with the gambling, the abuse that you had to deal with, but not only that, but also how you were able to sort out the things in your life that you felt needed to be sorted out. Not wanting to run away from your problems anymore, to just man up and face them head on. It's great to hear that you're in a better place now. It's great to hear that you have a healthy relationship with your daughters, and all that excess energy went into creativity, went into making music, went into writing a book, went into creating a podcast with a buddy of yours, doing all these things that you probably never would have had the time to do had you been bound and tied up to fighting your own demons and dealing with addiction. I'm happy that you found your happiness. And like you said, now living on your own terms. And for you, it's not about the shiny things. It's not about the big wheels. It's not about the big toys. It's about creating experiences, traveling, immersing yourself in different cultures. That's a beautiful thing, and I feel the same way about a lot of that. So just keep doing you unapologetically. You are a giant amongst us. Hope you guys enjoyed the conversation. If at all you feel inclined to check out what Justin is doing, check out his music, check out his podcast, or even check out his book, all of that information will be included in the show notes, so have at it. And as always, a big thank you to everybody listening. And for those of you who, each and every time there's a new conversation, you guys check with us and you lend an ear and spend some of your day with us. Appreciate you all. Let me know where you're listening from. Let me know how you listen to the show. Drop me a line. Shoot me an email. I'd be happy to hear from you. It's always great to get feedback. Whatever it is on your mind and you'd like to share, I'm all ears. And I'm thankful and grateful for everybody who's been a part of the show up until now. I look forward to bringing you guys more stories. And you guys be sure to check the show notes and follow the link so you can get information on what's going on with the show. Any side thoughts, any afterthoughts, any in-between the stories, any extra audio clips, because I want to start sprinkling some more of that on the side and just continue to build a good foundation and connect with people who have a story to tell, because we all have a unique story and experience. And you guys are welcome to give feedback. You guys are welcome to share your thoughts. You guys are welcome to shoot me a line and let me know how you feel about the show. And also, free of charge, you know, you can share this with a friend and tell a friend to tell a friend and tell that friend to come back again. Or on whichever streaming platform you're using, if you feel it within your heart to do so. If you feel that this has brought value to you, if you feel that these stories that you've heard have resonated with you, give it a rating Or you can always reach out to and send a line, send some warm words to the people who have shared their stories, any stories in particular that spoke to you or struck a chord with you. You guys be safe out there. You guys be sane. Tell your loved ones you love them. And we're going to catch up and do this again real soon. So before the sun sets on my side, if you would like to be a part of this show and share your story, or even a story of someone in your life that has impacted you in a positive way, you can always reach out to me via email. I'd be happy to connect. Until next time, and very soon, peace. Do-wop, do-wop, do-wop,
do-do, do-wop, do-wop. Looking for a sign to know I'm on the right road. Ain't seen no signs since Jericho.